Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and we're in Studio A, and my co-host Russ Chianelli is with us today. And we've got a very special guest. It's the first of its kind in two ways. It's a transatlantic discussion. We're going to be talking about all sorts of aspects of catalysis in the end, but solid-state materials in between. But Russ, this is a good friend of yours. Who are we going to be talking to today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Sir John Myrick Thomas. And if you look him up on the Internet, you'll find that it would take us the whole show just to list all his honors and positions. He's an honorary professor of material science at the University of Cambridge, an emeritus professor of chemistry at the David Faraday Research Laboratory of the Royal Institution. He has 20 honorary degrees, and I could go on and on. Welcome to Science Studio, Sir John.
Wow, great pleasure to be participating in this.
Well, we look forward to a very interesting and entertaining 28 minutes.
Good.
Before we get into you as the scientist, let's get into your sort of background. You as a young boy, I don't know how young you want to go, but what were those sort of pushing efforts that put you into a scientific career?
Well, I suppose, you know, I was brought up in the coalfield area of South Wales. My father and my brother were coal miners. My brother was 12 years older than me. And I was just fortunate that a new Act of Parliament in 1944, during the war, as a matter of fact, stipulated that all children up to the age of 16 would have free education. When I started going to the grammar school, which is your high school, my father had to pay my way through. And it's debatable whether if that Act of Parliament had not been passed, whether I'd have been ending up as a scientist or as a coal miner. But at any rate, it was when I was about 13, we had a fantastically interesting physics mistress. Now, up until that time, I really took very little interest actively in anything academic. I used to go bird watching, play rugby, play cricket, do all sorts of things. But on one particular day, I remember this mistress, Miss James, telling us about Michael Faraday, how this blacksmith's son, self-taught, you know, started life as a bookbinder's assistant, delivered newspapers in the streets of London, became, in due course, one of the greatest scientists of all time. In fact, many years later, Lord Rutherford described him as the greatest experimenter of all time. This chap started from nothing. Now, Miss James, in one particular lesson, told us how this man had used magnetism and converted it to electricity. That's the basis of all continuous electricity that we use, apart from a fuel cell and a few batteries and things of that kind. So, you know, Faraday became my hero. And from that moment onwards, not instantly, it wasn't, a Damascene conversion, but from that time onwards, I became quite studious. I mean, I used to do lots of other things, athletics. I was a race-walking champion and all that sort of thing. But as I grew older, I sensed that I was academically oriented. This pleased my father and my brother. And I went off to university, and I was brilliantly taught in a very small Welsh university in Swansea, where Dylan Thomas comes from. It's the area of Wales where, as Americans would know, Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins and others come from. We were brilliantly taught in chemistry, especially in physics, too, and in mathematics. So that's really the beginning.
Well, that's an interesting story, Sir John. I mean, and it's many, many of the scientists that we all know that have sort of been stimulated to wonderful things by a mistress. I went to an old boys' school, and I don't think we had any mistresses, if I can remember. But later on in life, things change. So you went off from Swansea. That was for your bachelor's of science degree.
Yes, I started my PhD, my doctorate there. But my supervisor was awarded a professorship in London University, in Queen Mary College, an area that you know well in the East End.
Absolutely.
And I spent a year there and finished my PhD. Then I worked in the atomic energy for a year, but didn't like that very much. The tasks I was given were not particularly interesting. And I always had a feeling, having been brought up in the tradition where you're exposed to great Welsh preachers, you know, I wanted to teach. I wanted to impart knowledge and to do a little bit of research. So I put my hat in the ring, as it were, and applied for a post in Bangor, North Wales. It's the place that gave the name of Bangor, Maine, but Bangor, North Wales, a small Welsh university college. I was there for 11 years. And that's where I really worked out my own sort of vision of what I wanted to do. And what I really wanted to do, because while I was in the Atomic Energy Authority, I was impressed by the young students, ex-young students, who could talk so expertly about the strength of materials, why metals could deform, why some things were brittle, why some metals corroded easily and why some didn't. So I then looked into the question of defects, imperfections in crystals, and that was the sort of mantra, if you like. It was the vision that I had of trying to make chemical sense of what the chemical consequences really were of imperfections in solids. And that stood me well. It took me to all sorts of places. It took me to America. It took me to Israel. It took me to Italy. It took me to France and also to Germany, describing my work. And I've always had a pleasure in reciting a story, almost like a storyteller, you know. Russ knows this. Russ himself has got that touch about him. He likes to tell a good tale. And there are so many good tales in chemistry and in science generally. So I then found, as it were, that I could mingle my educational activity of teaching. I did a tremendous amount of teaching. I didn't realize how much I was doing until I moved on to other places, and when I got to Cambridge, I was giving no more than about 25 lectures per academic year, whereas in Bangor, I used to give 160. So it was a huge difference. But
can I interject there, Sir John? I mean, yes, we all like to teach. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt. And I would sort of posit that perhaps the best teachers are the ones who are making discoveries.
And I tend to believe that, too.
So, but if you're teaching 125 at one university and 25 at another, this causes some rifts, some tension.
Yes, except that I was oblivious of the fact that if I were on the staff in Cambridge or in Oxford, that I wouldn't be doing so much teaching. I was tucked away behind the Welsh hills, so I was, as it were, protected from this knowledge, and I didn't worry about it. I just had to work harder, that's all. And also, I had excellent research students, many of whom were multifaceted. They could play football, play golf, play cricket, play hockey, play the church organ, and be good chemists. I had one phenomenal student who had a golf handicap of 4.
Oh.
Now, that's something, isn't it?
It's something I can't aspire to.
Well, Sir John, I have to interrupt and ask you a question, which always really interests me is, what about your experience during the war?
Well, I can remember that, well, you know, don't forget, I was born at the end of 1932, so I was growing up during the war, and the anxiety that we had in our home, my father was in the Home Guard, he fought in Gallipoli, he fought in Ypres, and he fought in the Somme. I mean, he'd been through the wars in a literal sense, and he was a big shot in the village as a member of the Home Guard. Now, Keith would know what that meant. That meant a sort of a reserve force that would help defend the village and the country should the Germans land. And Swansea was only about 15 miles away from me. I could see the flames rising above the city as a result of German bombing, because it was an industrial center. So I do have vivid recollections of the war. Mainly anxiety, I would say, until things gradually began to turn. And in 1944, well, as I told you, the 1944 Education Act clearly was something that Britain was already beginning to prepare for its post-war future.
Did in South Wales, was there such a concept as evacuation?
There was.
Because I was born in 1940, and I don't remember too many of them, but I know I was evacuated at least twice out of London.
And where did you go?
Well, one was down to Torquay in down in the southwest, and the other was into Lincolnshire.
Well, you see, we in my village had evacuees from London and evacuees from Swansea. Interestingly enough, one it was 250 miles away and one was less than 25 miles away. But they came to the village and they were non-Welsh-speaking. I was brought up in a Welsh-speaking part of the world. And some of these Cockneys, as we called them, were so incredibly versatile, quick-witted, and quick off the mark. And they were speaking Welsh within weeks of arriving in this monoglot village, which was most impressive. And some of them couldn't do that, of course, but others could, and it was extraordinary. We had a great time. In fact, much rivalry. We set up cricket teams, play against one another.
Let's move along a little bit, Sir John, into then this whole concept of materials and defects, because as you allude to, and our listeners won't know this particularly well, but it is the defects in structures which give really interesting properties. Pig iron from the Forest of Dean, which is relatively close to Wales.
That's right.
I mean, all the little pieces of carbon that got stuck into the iron gave it that extra strength. Why don't you talk to that a little?
Well, I mean, defects in materials generally, but particularly in metals, govern their properties to a very large degree. You know, many expert physicists up until the early 1930s could not understand why metals were not much, much stronger, much more, you know, tenacious, far less easy to bend and make malleable than they really were. There was something fundamentally wrong. All the calculations based on the assumption that one atom was beautifully arranged among a million other atoms in smooth planes and in perfectly vertical sheets and so forth, it was wrong. It was not until the electron microscope came along, and there was evidence then that there were enormous disparities between the regularity that had been pictured mentally and the actual state of affairs. And in fact, three people, two in Berlin and one in Cambridge, independently predicted the existence of what is known as a dislocation. Now, a dislocation is a simple word. It has a general meaning. But in the technical sense, it's a well-defined term where there's a disruption in the order of the atoms in a particular solid. And it's because of that dislocation, you only need one of them. And that is because that is there that is weak. Now, a Rolls-Royce jet engine, you can make an alloy of the kind that you were talking about, Keith, in such a way that there are no dislocations. Or if there are, they're locked. They cannot slide, and the metal can't glide and can't be bent. It's tough. So in this day and age, we know so much more about intermetallic compounds, alloys, and all sorts of other materials, ceramics, oxides, superconducting materials, etc. You can make them very largely either defect-free, or you introduce a deliberate quantity of defects in order to give them other properties which are desirable. I mean, you've heard of a fuel cell, I'm sure, where you burn hydrogen and oxygen and generate electricity. Well, you have to have a kind of electrolyte, a material that carries the current from one side of that cell to the other. And in order to do that effectively, you choose a material that can be made grossly defective, full of defects, full of dislocations, full of other types of defects. So you can play tunes. This is the artistry of the scientist.
Exactly. And we have to do a dislocation now, Sir John. We take a little break. This is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli and Sir John Myrick Thomas in Cambridge, England, by telephone, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. If you've been around young boys, you know they like to talk about disgusting bodily fluids like mucus, and we're about to do that.
Why? Is that because neither of us has grown up?
No, dummy, because mucus is one of our most valuable lines of defense against germs by providing a protective layer. And for the first time, scientists discovered that our mucus contained viruses called bacteriophage, or phage, that protect us from harmful bacteria.
Wait a minute. There are viruses that attack bacteria?
Viruses infect every living thing on Earth, including bacteria. Even other viruses. In the case of mucus, scientists found 40 phage for every bacterium. When just millimeters away where there's no mucus, the ratio drops to 5-1.
So are these phages protecting us? To find out, researchers grew two types of lung tissue in the lab, one that produced mucus and one that couldn't. Once infected with bacteria, half the cells in both cultures died.
When the bacteria-killing phage were added, the survival of the lung cells skyrocketed in the mucus culture. They also noticed the outside of phage is studded with antibody-like proteins that keep it attached to the carbohydrates in the mucus. This helps keep phage where bacteria are likely to be.
Perhaps our bodies have adapted carbohydrates in our mucus to select for phages that protect us, creating a symbiotic relationship.
Next, scientists want to understand how this affects our body's balance of microbial populations and diseases such as obesity and inflammatory bowel diseases. With so few examples of beneficial viruses, this is an important one to study.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Sir John Myrick Thomas in Cambridge, England, and we are talking about materials, dislocations, weaknesses, strengths. And, Russ, I know you're dying to ask a particular question.
Well, it's just that when you're talking about the defects in stainless steels and this type of thing is that one of the reasons that's very interesting today is on a spaceship that can go out and come back.
That's right.
We need better materials.
Absolutely. Well, there's always a quest for even more and more tenacious, hard, impenetrable, non-rusting, and almost everlasting materials.
So, John, I noticed when I was looking through your sort of activities and one of the interesting awards that I saw you get, I didn't quite understand it, and I didn't do any research into it, was it a Green Award from the American Chemical Society?
Yes. It was from the presidential office, actually. Now, that occurred almost by accident. I agreed with my friend Bob Grubbs, who is at Caltech, a Nobel Prize winner, and another gentleman, Jim Dye, who was in Michigan State University,
yes,
to serve on the scientific academic board of a small American company based in New Jersey. And we concocted some propositions as to how we could improve the efficacy of certain reactions and do so in a clean way. You know, the big drive these days in chemical science, in science generally, is to do things in a non-wasteful way, is to use oxygen rather than, say, nitric acid to oxidize something, is to generate materials in a simple, straightforward, single-step process, if you can. All these things are called part and parcel of green chemistry. And what we did was effectively that on a particular material with sodium, generating hydrogen in a very nice, safe, and reliable way without doing it in a dangerous fashion.
And how nice that somebody from the green valleys of South Wales, green is my valley, how green is...
Tom Jones' green grass of home.
So talk to that end to a little bit. I mean, you see that this is sort of one of the areas that really science should be concentrating on, especially the chemists.
Well, yes. Let me give you another example. You know, every bowl of cereal that is consumed pretty well anywhere in the world has a small vitamin content, a vitamin B3. It's niacin. In fact, the proper name for it is nicotinic acid. It sounds terrible, but it's a very essential material for growth. If you look at a Kellogg's container and look carefully at the contents, you see the word niacin. Now, niacin can be produced from nicotine, which is not a nice stuff. As you know, nicotine can be nasty. And the way it's one big method of producing niacin industrially is to take chromic oxide, which is, for those of you who are chemists, CrO3, three oxygens and one chromium atom. And that's a very powerful and environmentally aggressive oxidizing agent. When you place that in contact with nicotine, it gives you the niacin, but it generates nitrogen dioxide, carbon dioxide, water, and Cr2O3, another oxide of chromium. So it's very messy. It's not economical. Well, it is economical because there's the price that you get from the final product is much higher than what you get from what you start from. But the point I'm making is it's an environmentally harmful method of generating a highly desirable material. Now, in my catalysis, my colleagues and I here in Cambridge and in Southampton, we devised a single step for doing that using a catalyst. And now everybody knows what a catalyst is. A catalyst is an agent that speeds up the rate at which reactions proceed. The great trick is to choose the right catalyst or to design the right catalyst. Now, Russ is an expert in this as well. And I take some pride in the fact that I've been able, using some chemical common sense and a bit of manipulative dexterity and being a kind of molecular architect, to design a catalyst that does this particular reaction and certain other reactions. You can produce a fair number of quite important pharmaceuticals, for example, in this general way by not resorting to extremely expensive and aggressive and environmentally harmful ways.
So just give us a clue, Sir John. What was this particular new material that you put together for the niacin synthesis?
Well, I'll tell you, it's all begun because, you know, there are naturally occurring aluminosilicates. You know, silicon and aluminium extensively occur in the surface of the Earth. In the planet, everywhere, you know, and then oxygen. Now, aluminium and silicon sometimes combine in such a way that they form solids that are full of open spaces. They're called zeolites. In fact, they were discovered in Sweden in 1756. They call them zeolites because those empty spaces are full of water. When you take the naturally occurring mineral zeolite and heat it, it boils. It's solid, actually boils. And zeolite simply means that, the solid that boils. Now, in Union Carbide in America, in Chicago, around about 1992, they discovered that instead of using aluminium silicon, you could use aluminium and phosphorus. And these are cheap materials. There's plenty of phosphorus on Earth, too. I mean, Coca-Cola wouldn't exist, and neither would Pepsi-Cola if there was not enough phosphorus on the Earth. Now, we discovered that we could manipulate aluminium phosphates in such a way as to make them very largely materials with three-dimensional surfaces. They were so teeming with cavities and cages and channels that the inside was also the outside, if you see what I mean. It's a huge surface area. And not only that, we could place a specific element of our choice to replace the aluminium. And what we chose was manganese in the three oxidation state. It's very similar in size to aluminium. Now, that confers upon this otherwise neutral solid, which doesn't do anything, it confers immensely powerful catalytic oxidative ability. And in the presence of a source of oxygen, with that particular catalyst, that atom that we've put there, we can oxidize even the most recalcitrant of organic materials. That's essentially, in flowery terms, what we did.
Sir John, I'd like to back you up a little bit and mention that there's a book that everybody in heterogeneous catalysis read, and that's Thomas and Thomas, Principles and Practice of Heterogeneous Catalysis, and you have a new version coming out, correct?
Yes, I have, having spent 8 or 10 years, actually, Russ, to try and bring it up to date. It's such a fast-moving field. You and your friends in Texas are producing large numbers of important papers, which I can't ignore. Which I've got to read, which I've got to refer to.
Well, in Texas, we found a way to ignore at least some of them, but not all of them.
But the
author, Sir John, said Thomas and Thomas. Was this a relative or just somebody?
No. Well, Thomas in Wales is like Patel in Gujarat or Schmidt in Germany, right? You know, Thomas is... No, W.J. Thomas was... about 5 years older than me. He was a teacher in Swansea when I was a graduate student, and we became very friendly. He became an expert in a chemical engineer. He's still alive, but he's sadly totally blind now, having lost an eye playing rugby, Keith.
Oh, dear. What position?
Yeah.
He must have been in the scrum.
He was forward, yeah.
Exactly.
He was age 17, and he lost the sight in his other eye. But he is the chemical engineer, and I'm the chemist. And Russ is quite right, and we're very proud of this book. It deals with the entire gamut of all the things that you need to know, from the laboratory-oriented study to the industrial study to the industrial application. I mean, nowadays, it's such a fast-moving area. You can design a catalyst and design a process almost at the same time. You can do things like lab on a chip, or you can do microfluidics, or you can do all sorts of other rather bigger reactors.
It's absolutely amazing, the scope for scientific discovery. But that brings up to a little discussion that Russ and I often have. Russ is very much clear in the nature of his approach to science is you find a problem and you try to solve it, but the problem has got to sort of impact society. Whereas, I must say, when I grew up, I went to the University of Durham, and you look for problems, but they don't necessarily have to be the problem that society is thinking about. How to make a silicon transition metal multiple bond, for example.
Yes.
That fine balance between these two. I'd like you to discuss
it's
that a little.
What I call the ivory tower versus helping people with your research.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that drove me into catalysis, I mean, when I was a research student in Swansea, I was just getting acquainted with catalysis, but I was doing other things. I was evaporating carbon, trying to get carbon films, and wondering whether they were diamond-like or graphite-like. But I realized when I became a lecturer in Bangor, North Wales, and I had to do a lot of teaching, I opted to teach a great deal in catalysis. But I also realized that I had to have money to do my research. And as a consequence, I decided that I would choose a subject which was, I knew, of vital importance to many different industries.
So, John, I'm sorry to interrupt you in full flight, but we do have to bring an end to this. It's been absolutely a pleasure to have you here, and I hope perhaps we can do this again and talk about bigger issues of how, in fact, we push forward science.
My pleasure.
And we shall be back next week with another Science Studio. It may not be as far away as Cambridge, England, but it'll be just as interesting, we hope, and you be there. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Splash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation recently launched a capital campaign to support construction of El Paso's first ever biomedical research building. The $37 million building will be the first structure on El Paso's first tech park, also being developed by the MCA Foundation. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital, a transitional care hospital for extended stay patients.